The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I am Melissa Greenberg. I am the Vice President of the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation, and I am delighted to welcome you all here to Parkway Central this morning. Thank you for starting your morning with us. You are here as part of the Free Library's author event series. And this is actually a relatively new part of our series called Leading Voices, which brings great minds from the business world to the Free Library early in the morning so that you can all get here and then get back to work. A lot of you know this, but just to remind you, the Free Library is an incredible public-private partnership. We are unique among almost all major urban public libraries because while we receive great support from our city, we could not exist without the Free Library Foundation that supports all the things that happen right here at Parkway Central, but also in 60 other locations around the city. So to so many of you that support us, I thank you. And for those of us that might be thinking about a new philanthropic investment, think about the library because your dollars will go a long, long way. I want to remind everyone, please turn off your cell phones. There's no flash photography. And of course, look for our next business author event, which is Amy Cuddy. She will be here on February 25th, and tickets are going fast, so go online and get those. We're here this morning to welcome Adam Grant to our stage. I'm sure it will be a fascinating conversation. You all know Adam because you're here, but I'll remind you that he is the youngest tenured professor at Wharton, just up the street, and we are thrilled that he is here this morning to talk about his new book, Originals: How Nonconformists Move the World. So ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome Adam Grant.
Morning, everyone. So I have a confession to make, which is one of the worst things that ever happened to me was in the very first class that I taught at Penn. I had this student named Neil who came in and said, "I'm thinking about starting a company, and I'm wondering if you want to invest in this company." And I was like, "Do not ever, ever give money to students," was my rule. So I wanted to know a little bit more before I made a final decision. And I said, "What are you guys thinking about doing?" And he said, "Well, we want to disrupt an industry. We have this big idea. We're going to sell stuff online." Like, okay, I think that's been done before. But tell me a little bit about how you guys spent the summer. Did you work on the business full time? And they said, "No, not really. We actually all got internships because we weren't really sure if this business was going to work out." "All right, but you guys are going to make a full-time commitment once you graduate, right?" "Not so much. We've all taken full-time jobs, just in case." So I'm not impressed, but I watch them for the next few months, and 6 months go by, and they still don't have a website the day before their company is scheduled to launch. I'm like, "You realize the whole business is a website, right?" So obviously I declined to invest, and a few years later, they made the news. They named the company Warby Parker. They sell glasses online. They were just valued at over $1 billion and named the most innovative company in the world by Fast Company. And now my wife handles all our investments. Now, this sent me on a little bit of a tailspin. Why was I so wrong about Warby Parker? And what could we learn from my mistake? And most importantly, how could I avoid ever doing that again? So I began studying originals. For me, originals are people who stand out and speak up. They're people who drive creativity and change in the world, who not only have creative ideas and bold insights, but take initiative to make those ideas a reality and bring their visions into the world. And I discovered that a lot of us are dead wrong about what it takes to be original. I certainly was. And my guess is that some of you might be too. So I started by tracking down somebody else who was thinking about original ideas for a long time, but saw potential where everyone else missed it. Some of you may remember this TV show. It was called Seinfeld, and it dominated most of my childhood. as the only reason that some of us went to literature class, because we got to talk about Seinfeld all day, and the only thing that led the nerds and the jocks to sit at the same lunch table and have some common ground to discuss. Now, as many of you remember, Seinfeld had a disastrous first run with its pilot episode. In front of test audiences, the pilot was rated not only weak, but a weak week. And it was not renewed. The test audience said that they thought the characters were boring, completely unrelatable, and the report on the pilot concluded that no segment of the audience was excited to watch the show again. So how did Seinfeld survive? There was one guy, Rick Ludwin, who made a bet on it, who said, "I think this show is going to be great," and avoided the false negative that every other studio executive committed. Well, how did he do it? Rick Ludwin had this great advantage over everyone else who worked at NBC, which is he didn't work in sitcoms. He came from the variety and specials department. So he wasn't stuck in one particular way of viewing a sitcom. He didn't say, "You know, the plot lines never get resolved, so why would anyone watch that?" He just said, "This makes me laugh, so we should put this on TV." And that led me to the first insight about originals that I had missed, which is they don't have necessarily the deepest expertise in their fields. They have the broadest experience. If you study the world's most innovative fashion designers, one of the things you will find really quickly is the ones who stand out as the most original in their field are the ones who have worked abroad for the longest time in the countries most different from their own. So if you're an American, not that helpful to go be a tourist in Canada. Although it's maybe helpful to the Canadian economy, but not going to boost your creativity, right? What you want to do is go to Latin America or Eastern Europe or Southeast Asia and go and work there. So you have to internalize new ways of seeing the world, and you can bring that back to the way that you design. This is not just limited to fashion designers, though. Back in 1982, Steve Jobs observed that the key to his creativity was not having the same bag of experiences as everyone else. Now, unfortunately, the particular bag of experiences that Jobs chose is illegal in most countries. But there's some real value to broadening your knowledge beyond the field or domain that you're in. And this was one of the things that the Warby Parker guys did so well. None of them came from the glasses industry. They weren't stuck in the conventions of retail or fashion. Neil, the student that I had, had spent a bunch of time trying to get people to use glasses in the developing world and running a nonprofit that was giving glasses away so that people who couldn't see could start their own businesses. And he had a radically different understanding of how cheaply you can make glasses from that experience. But it's not just entrepreneurs who benefit from this, scientists too. Brilliant study of Nobel Prize-winning scientists asks, what do they do differently from other scientists who are technically skilled but not original? And one of the big differences is, if you look at their hobbies, Nobel Prize-winning scientists are twice as likely as their peers to play a musical instrument, like Albert Einstein did. They are 7 times as likely to paint or dabble in the arts. They are 12 times as likely to write creative fiction, poetry, and they are 22 times as likely to be actors, dancers, or, get this, magicians in their spare time. Now, as a former magician, I was quite excited by this evidence. My wife often reminds me that magicians are at the very bottom of the hierarchy of entertainers, only above mimes. But I came back to her with these data and said, look, Nobel Prize-winning scientists are magicians. There is hope for me yet. Now, why do we see great scientists having hobbies in the arts, in music? Well, some of this is just natural curiosity, right? Curious people are drawn to new ideas, and they are also drawn to expressing themselves artistically. But there is a case to be made that the time you spend in the arts can make you a better scientist. Don't take it from me. Take it from some scientist that a few of you might have heard of. His name was Galileo. One of Galileo's greatest discoveries was seeing mountains on the moon, which no one else had ever spotted. And this was eye-opening to anyone who lived in Galileo's era and believed that the moon didn't necessarily have the same kinds of craters and geographic features that the Earth did. Now, what's fascinating about Galileo is that he was not the first person to look through a telescope and see the discovery that led him to realize there were mountains on the moon. But he was the first one to recognize them. So these are Galileo's drawings. Other astronomers had looked at the exact same image but didn't spot them. Why? Galileo was trained in a drawing technique that involves special shading. And from the shading that he learned to do, he realized that the kinds of shadows he was seeing through his telescope meant that there had to be ridges and changes in elevation. So training in art actually led him to see these mountains. Now, not all of us are going to specialize in drawing. We're not all going to dance or do creative fiction. But there's a tremendous amount of value that comes from broadening your experience. It might be something as simple as just working in a different job for a couple of days, doing a little bit of a rotation, testing out a new skill that gives us a chance to see the world a different way. Now, related to that, the second thing I learned about originals is that they reject prototypes. When it came to Seinfeld, what most of the executives did was they took a look at what sitcoms had been successful in the past, and then they compared this pilot to it and said, yeah, normally these shows are about something. Show about nothing? Not going to work so well. Rick Ludwin didn't do that because he didn't even work in sitcoms. He worked in variety and specials, where he was constantly experimenting with different formats. And he had a chance to see that there were lots of different ways to make people laugh and that you didn't have to follow one cookie cutter recipe. It is amazing how often people fail to do that. Now, I don't want to throw anyone who works in publishing under the bus here, but there was a book that was submitted to several publishers and rejected over and over again because, and I quote, it was too long for a children's book. Now, those of you who have read Harry Potter, if anything, you are upset that those books are not long enough, right? Because you never want a story about wizards to end. What's amazing is how few publishing executives ever sat down and looked at, would kids engage with this book? And in fact, the publisher that finally did make the bet on Harry Potter was the one where an executive gave it to his 8-year-old daughter. And she said, I love this. I want more. It wasn't about asking, does this fit the mold of a successful children's book? It was about asking, would a kid read this book? So you have to get good at rejecting prototypes if you want to be an original. And I was disastrous at this. My prototype for a successful entrepreneur when I looked at the Warby Parker investment was, did you quit your job and go all in? I was thinking about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg dropping out of school and going for broke. I overlooked the fact that many successful entrepreneurs don't do that. In fact, there's a study looking at entrepreneurs who quit their jobs versus those who just start their companies on the side. And that second group, the ones who begin as a hobby, are 33% less likely to fail. Now, why would that be? Largely what it seems to be is that they buy themselves flexibility. That if you quit your job and your entire livelihood depends on your company, you feel a lot of pressure to rush your product to market, to make sure that the first idea you try is successful. Whereas if you're just tinkering on the side and it doesn't work out, you can pivot, you can move on, you can try new ideas until you actually perfect your startup. And we see this with actually many of the great entrepreneurs of our time. When Sarah Blakely started Spanx, she had this great idea for footless pantyhose, but for 2 years she sold fax machines by day. And she spent those 2 years working nights and weekends to try to get her prototype right and get enough patents that she could one day become America's youngest self-made billionaire. Not bad. Right? We see this in lots of contexts. The founders of Google, Nike, Minecraft, all had in common sticking around in their day commitments for months or even years before they finally made the leap. So you don't have to fit the prototype of the risk-taking, go-for-glory, daredevil entrepreneur in order to be a successful original, was a big lesson for me. Now, one of the things that I learned about how to judge whether people are original and whether new ideas will take off came from Justin Berg. Justin was a brilliant student who's now a professor at Stanford. And Justin wanted to know, how do you get good at predicting whether a new idea is going to make it or not? And he studied circus artists. Think Cirque du Soleil. He got hundreds of circus artists to submit videos of their performances. So you had jugglers, you had acrobats, you had clowns. One lesson from the study is no one ever likes clowns. Everyone hates the performances that clowns submit. But with all the other kinds of acts, could you predict which ones were going to be big hits with their audiences? So we got circus artists themselves to judge the acts. He got managers to judge them too. And then he got over 13,000 audience members to watch the videos, to rate how much they liked them, to share them on social media if they wanted to, and to donate some of their own money to the performers as an index of, would you actually pay money to see these people do their circus acts? Now, circus artists themselves were terrible judges of their own performances. They were way too positive because they thought that their acts were going to be really extraordinary, and other people looked at that and they were like, you really should not be a clown, ever. Managers, though, were bad too, and they were bad for the opposite reason. They were not too positive, they were too negative. Managers, especially middle managers, were risk-averse. They were able instantly to imagine all the reasons that the most novel acts would fail, and they did the exact same thing that the NBC executives did with Seinfeld and that I did with Warby Parker. They compared the acts they saw to previous acts that were successful, and they said, the more different this is, the less I want to bet on it. And so that didn't work out too well. There was a third group that was extremely good at predicting which novel acts would take off, and that was peers, fellow circus artists judging each other's acts. They had enough distance, unlike the circus artists themselves, to say, you know, you really should go back up to the drawing board on that. But unlike the managers, they were invested in originality, and they were much more likely to take a look at these new acts and say, that's different from anything I've ever seen before, but I see real potential in it. So one lesson from this is you should go to your peers whenever you have a new idea, fellow creators, to get their feedback, because they're going to give you some honest feedback, but they will also look for the potential, not just the reasons to reject it. Another lesson, though, is that Justin was able to figure out how to make the managers more open to novelty. What he did was, right before they had to evaluate other people's ideas, he had them spend 5 minutes generating ideas of their own. And just 5 minutes thinking up ideas, brainstorming, was enough to open their minds and make them better judges of other people's creative ideas. So anytime you have to vet other people's ideas, you want to get yourself in a creative mindset first. And that gets you thinking about creating, as opposed to just evaluating and shooting things down. I wish I had done that before Warby Parker came around. Now, the third thing that I learned about originality was rooted in my childhood. When I was 7 years old, my mother called our local newspaper and said, my son is addicted to Nintendo and it's frying his brain. And this was the result. This is me playing Metroid. I had a little more hair then. But what video games taught me, more than anything else, was how important it was to be disciplined and start things early. I discovered that when I set my alarm to wake up at 5 a.m., so I had time to play Nintendo before I went to school, that I was able to master video games much faster than my friends, and then when they came over after school playing what they thought was a new game, I was able to beat all of them, because I'd already spent a few hours working on it, which I did not disclose to any of them. But I thought this was a really valuable habit to learn, and it's something that I carried through my childhood into my adulthood. When I was in college, I came to believe that anything worth doing was worth doing early, and I made it a point to try to finish everything in advance. I turned in my senior thesis 4 months before it was due, and my roommates told me later that they once threw a party while I was writing, and I didn't even notice. And this kind of commitment to getting things done ahead made me really productive. And I found recently that there was a name for my habits. It's the opposite of procrastination. I was a precrastinator. Now, for those of you who share this habit, precrastination is if you have a speech to give in 6 months, you will wake up tomorrow feeling this tremendous sense of urgency to get it done now. And that's how I've lived a lot of my professional life. But I had a student, Jihei Shin, who came to me and said, I have my most creative ideas when I am procrastinating. And I was like, that's insane. And then I thought about it. She was one of my most creative students, and I wanted to know more. And I said, well, could you prove it? Like, what we do as social scientists is we come up with these ideas and we test them. So go and get some data. Convince me, in fact, that procrastination could drive creativity. So she went and studied people in a bunch of different companies. She asked them how often they procrastinate, and then she got their bosses to rate how creative and innovative they were. And the procrastinators were more creative. And I was like, well, wait a minute. What about the people who procrastinate so much that they don't do any actual work? And she looked at the data, and it turns out there was a curvilinear relationship, so there's a sweet spot. Procrastinating some predicted creativity, but if you procrastinated all the time, your boss was like, yeah, where's that report you promised me 3 months ago? Maybe it's creative, but I never saw it. But then I started wondering, okay, maybe it's just that creative people happen to procrastinate, right? They don't like to adhere to schedules. They don't want to rush their idea processes. So maybe there's not really a causal effect of procrastinating on creativity. So then she went into the lab and she designed an experiment to try to prove that procrastinating could make you more creative. The way she did this was she had people come up with new business ideas. We did this in West Philadelphia. So what she did was she took an empty space on campus and she said, can you come up with an idea for a new business that should start there? And she got independent raters to evaluate how creative and original the different proposals were. Before that, though, she randomly assigned some people to procrastinate. So some people were told to start working on their business idea right away. Others were told about the task, but they were asked to play Minesweeper or Solitaire first and put off the task of working on the business proposal for a few minutes. And guess what? That group was 28% more creative on average than the people who dove right in and started the task. Now, playing Minesweeper is awesome, but that is not the driver of creativity. What happened was when people played Minesweeper, they were much more likely to incubate. Instead of rushing forward with their first idea, which was usually the most conventional, they had some time to think about some other possibilities, which are a little bit more unusual. They were less likely to engage in linear thinking. Instead of just marching forward with one plan, they let a bunch of ideas sort of swirl around, and then they were able to bet on one that was a little bit different. And what was interesting was when people played Minesweeper before they were told the task, there was no creativity advantage. It was only when you knew what you were supposed to be working on and put it off that your unconscious mind was processing and that you came up with new ideas. So I thought, this is great. Procrastinating can actually cause people to be more creative. And when Jihei was doing this, I happened to be in the middle of writing a book called Originals. And I thought, why don't I test this in the chapter on procrastination? So I'm going to meta-procrastinate. I'm going to procrastinate on my procrastination chapter, which freaked my editor out a lot. I still turned in the book 2 months early, but there were a few days that were really harrowing. And two interesting things came out of this process. The first one was I found that the days that I literally delayed the starting of a task, I was more creative when I finally got to it. So I wanted to sit down and write this chapter about procrastination, and I was tempted to just write about the research. I put it off for a couple days, and you know, it's kind of working in the back of my mind, and I'm feeling a lot of stress, because those of you who are procrastinators, you know that stress you feel when it's time to pull an all-nighter and something is due in a few hours and you haven't even started? That's how I feel like 5 days in advance, right? So I am just panicking that I haven't started. And I'm sitting in meetings, and I start remembering that there are cool examples of people who procrastinated, who are really successful in history. One of them was Leonardo da Vinci. And I want to just illustrate this quickly with a cartoon that another former student made. Da Vinci spent up to 16 years procrastinating on The Last Supper and almost as long on the Mona Lisa. And he would literally paint a brushstroke and then kind of get distracted and work on something else. He was like, I gotta finish this painting, but he couldn't force himself to do it. And he wrote in his journal consistently, tell me if anything ever was done. He was so plagued by chronic procrastination that he felt like a failure. What he didn't realize, though, was that procrastinating was part of what made him the Renaissance man. Because when he was supposed to be focused on painting, and he got really curious about, could I do this little experiment in optics? He ended up making a discovery that allowed him to cast light in a different way and become one of the greatest painters of the Renaissance era. And so all of those seemingly random diversions that he went on actually had some relevance to his ultimate painting. And I also discovered there were contemporary examples of great procrastinators. Many of Steve Jobs' closest collaborators have told me that he was a chronic procrastinator and that he never liked to pull the trigger on an idea until the very last minute because he wanted full freedom to let all the ideas develop. And I think that this is fascinating. I think that you could also find that people in television procrastinate frequently. Anyone who ever watched The West Wing, for example, or the Steve Jobs movie, Aaron Sorkin, is known to procrastinate so much that it's time to film and there is still no script. Katie Couric interviewed Sorkin about this, and she said, how do you get away with all this procrastinating? You are a writer. What you do is write. But you just seem to sit around and do nothing. And Sorkin said, well, it's really simple. You call it procrastinating. I call it thinking. What a great way to reframe procrastinating. So one of the things I learned about great originals is that they know how to delay. They do not rush into action. They are often late to the party. And a lot of people believe that if you want to do something original, you need to be first. But actually, the first mover advantage is a myth.
Classic study by Golder and Tellis shows that if you look at companies that have entered their market first, the pioneers, their failure rate is 47%. The settlers who follow them, 8% failure rate. It's a lot easier to improve on somebody else's idea than it is to create a market for a brand new idea to begin with. And had I known this, I might have placed a bet on Warby Parker. Because in the 6 months that they spent not creating the website that was supposed to launch their company, they were testing over 2,000 ideas for the name of their company. They knew that if you want to create an iconic retail brand, you need to have a name that's sophisticated, that's unique, and has no negative associations. And it wasn't until 6 months and over 2,000 ideas were tested with potential customers that one of the founders happened to be reading through the unpublished journals of Jack Kerouac and saw that there were two characters named Warby and Parker and thought, gee, maybe if I combine that, that would be a really great name. They tested it and it worked. Around that time, GQ called them the Netflix of eyewear and they took off. Not bad. The last thing important that I learned about originals was that they had a great skill of making unfamiliar things seem familiar. And I want to give you a chance to practice this for a second. So what I'd like you to do is think of a song, any song. This will be the easiest task you are given today. And in a moment, I'm going to ask you to tap the rhythm of the song and try to have the person next to you guess it. Now, before you do this, you may want to change to an easier song than the first one you thought of. But also, I'd like you to come up with a probability estimate for the odds that the person sitting next to you will recognize your song, anywhere from 0 to 100%. When you're ready, have one person tap, the other will guess, and then we'll come back together. Go. All right, stop. Some of you had way too much fun with this. But those of you who have kids, when they ask you what you did at work this morning, you can just tap. Now, I think this exercise is fascinating for a couple reasons. One, I'd like you to stand up if you guessed correctly and stay standing, please. Impressive. Yeah, round of applause. So when I name your song, you can sit down. Happy birthday. Row, row, row your boat. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. Also known as the ABCs. Jingle Bells. Mary Had a Little Lamb. Frère Jacques. We Will Rock You. The Rocky theme song. Star Wars. All right, what did you guys have?
Beethoven 7.
I can't even tap the fifth. I don't know how you did that.
Margaritaville.
All right. So those, I want to hear just quickly your probability estimates. How many people guessed 100%? Anyone? 0%? Okay, I want to know if you were doubting yourself or the person sitting next to you. How many people were in the 0 to 25% range? 25 to 50? 50 to 75? 75 to 100. Okay, so this was an actual study done at Stanford where people are assigned to tap an easy song and then they are given the chance to then do their probability estimates, and then we find out how many people really recognize it. And the average tapper thinks that 50% of people will recognize an easy song like Happy Birthday. But when they tap, they are off the mark by more than an order of magnitude, because the average listener only guesses at a 2.5% rate. You thought 1 in 2 would get it, but 1 in 40 get it. Why? You guys are way better than the Stanford people, by the way. Go Philly. But What's amazing is it is impossible to tap this song without hearing the music in your head, right? I challenge you to try it. You can't do it. And that makes it humanly impossible to imagine what your disjointed tapping sounds like to someone who is not hearing the song, right? So I'm hearing da-da-da-da-da-da, and you're hearing, what the hell is that? I think this is a great metaphor for presenting original ideas. Because when you are communicating a new idea to someone, you not only are hearing the tune in your head, you wrote the song, right? You came up with the idea. You have spent months thinking about it. And that makes it really hard to imagine what it sounds like to someone who is not hearing the lyrics or the melody in their head over and over and over again. So what people have to do to succeed with original ideas is they have to take their novel, radical possibilities and make them seem familiar. One of my favorite examples of this was with a great movie that Disney made. Disney was trying to make their first ever animated movie based on an original script. So previously, they'd just taken old fairy tales and animated them. Now they want to try to write their own fairy tale. And they go in and pitch this script to Jeffrey Katzenberg, and he says, this is terrible. This is like a B-movie. And they go back to the drawing board, they rewrite it, and they pitch it again. And everybody's just sitting there scratching their head. And finally, Michael Eisner chimes in and says, could this be King Lear? Now, coincidentally, Rob Minkoff, who is the director of this movie, had reread King Lear 3 weeks earlier, which is apparently what you do when you work at Disney. You read Shakespeare for fun. And he said, no, this script has nothing to do with King Lear. And then there's a producer sitting in the back of the room, Maureen Donnelly, who shouts out, could this be Hamlet? And all of a sudden, it clicks. And they rewrite the script, which is going to be a movie, Hamlet with lions, and becomes The Lion King. And becomes the most successful movie of 1994. Now, some other movie, Frozen, has displaced The Lion King as Disney's greatest success. But if you could let that go for me. The Lion King is so interesting. It started out as Bambi in Africa with lions. That was literally the pitch for it. And people are like, no. But once you call it Hamlet and you connect it to this iconic story, people are like, of course that makes sense. The uncle is going to kill the father, and then the son has to avenge the father's death. And now we get it. And this crazy idea for a movie about lions all makes sense. And that's what great originals learn to do. And this is what Warby Parker learned to do, that unfortunately I did not listen to. They learned to say, we are going to be just like Zappos for shoes. We are going to be just like diapers.com with diapers. We are going to be just like Amazon with books, only that didn't work because Amazon sells everything. But I think this is why you see a lot of startups now pitching themselves as the Uber for X. Because all of a sudden it takes something unfamiliar and it makes it familiar. And that's what you have to do in order to communicate an original idea, right? I wish I had sat down and had this thought of what is Warby Parker now going to do that other people have done in other domains? And I realized, you know, because originals are often late to the party, it's never too late. So last month I called up Neil Blumenthal and I said, you know, I realized that I declined to invest in your company, but I've done some informal advising and I'm hoping maybe there's still a shot at some equity. And I asked him, you know, what have you been thinking all the way along? And he said, well, actually, we weren't really that upset when you turned us down to invest back in 2009, because what does a professor know about starting a business anyway? With that, I would love to take your questions. Thank you.
My name's Gail Ball. I'm with a bank here in the Philadelphia area. Which I think actually might be a good making my question familiar to the unfamiliar. In your article that was in the New York Times this weekend, which I think derived from this, there was something in there about the creative people having grown up in environments where they had the opportunity to create their own ethical framework.
Yeah.
And you didn't talk about that attribute in your remarks today. Could you touch a little bit more on that and the influence of the ethical framework on creativity?
I could. Yeah, well, thank you for reading, Gail. I deliberately left that out in the fear that somebody might have read the article and then we would be completely redundant. But there's a lot that was unsaid in the article. So chapter 6, enjoy it. No. this was fascinating to me. So you look at classic studies of creative architects. So the most successful architects in America nominate the people they admire in their field most, like the Frank Lloyd Wrights, as being truly original. And then psychologists go and interview them and get their entire life histories and hang out with their families, and they compare them with technically skilled but unoriginal architects. And what stands out is the parents of the really original architects, one of the things they did was they didn't focus on rules, they focused on values. They said, look, let's talk about what kind of person we want you to be. But instead of shoving their own ethical code down their children's throats, they engaged their children in dialogue about what principles do you want to stand for. So what the parents would usually do is they'd start out with broad values. They'd say things like, excellence is really important to us. What does success mean to you? And then they'd have an open discussion about it.
Or, you know, we really care about the consequences of your actions for other people. What kind of impact do you want to have on the people around you? What happened was then their kids started to internalize their own values. And when it came time to go against the grain and reject the norms of the field and be nonconformists, they were comfortable doing that, saying, this is who I am and this is what I stand for. They were also much more likely to think about being original because they were concerned about what their contribution was going to be, right? All those conversations about being a good person, about empathy, about respect, about integrity, had to do with thinking about, you know, my art is not just self-expression. It's going to leave a mark. It's going to have an imprint. And what do I want that to look like? And so I think that gave them the courage to act in domains that might have led them to get a lot of ridicule and rejection. I think it also gave them, to some degree, the confidence and the enthusiasm to say, I want to do something that matters to other people. So that's, I think, the punchline of what that research was about. Gail, did I answer your question? Thank you for asking it. Who's our next victim?
Thanks for your presentation, Adam. I did go to that school where you teach, and I have a little concern with education, and I've made a few films and books over the years and working on something on education now, and I found that most of the emphasis is on teaching, not on learning, and of course mistakes are penalized, and it's very much about consume and then give it back to the professor. So what's going to happen to change the nature of education, for instance, where you are, where creativity was not a word that was used very often, except for a few professors who aren't there anymore. And, you know, at Stanford, they had a class on creativity and business, Michael Ray, and I don't see anything happening. So maybe you can give me some hope.
Well, I think that you have a little concern about education. I have a lot of concern about it. I think we are doing a great job selecting, developing, and rewarding ambitious robots. Kids who are really great at internalizing everything that's already known and have no training whatsoever in how to think differently. And I think, frankly, I've been part of the problem since the day that I started teaching. So there's this interesting thing that happens when you start writing a book, which is you confront your own hypocrisy, and you realize that you're not doing a lot of the things that you may recommend or write about. And one of the things I noticed was my class, I believe really strongly, so I teach organizational behavior, it's a mix of management and psychology. I believe really strongly in teaching based on evidence. I want students to make decisions based on good data, on randomized controlled experiments, on longitudinal studies, not just make stuff up based on what gurus might think or based on their own idiosyncratic experiences. I realized, though, that the dark side of that was I was basically teaching them to memorize things that were already known, and not teaching them to generate their own ideas about how to lead, how to manage, how to work. So 2 years ago, I tried an experiment. And I said, look, if I'm going to write a book about originality, I've got to learn how to inject this more into my classroom. And I asked the students to pair up. And one of their biggest assignments for the class was they had to film a TED Talk. And it had to be about an idea that they believed in that was worth spreading, but that deliberately went against the grain. That very few people would agree with them on. And I asked them to tell a story about why it mattered, to bring some piece of data that could help to support their argument, and to come up with creative formats for delivering it. And I was blown away by the originality that got unleashed. There were all these students who had great ideas, and they'd never been given a chance to express them in the classroom. Two of those students, Nicole and Sarah, are sitting here right now and know a lot more about this than I do. But I would love to see more assignments of that variety, and I feel like I've only scratched the surface of what it's going to take to encourage that kind of thinking. One proposal that I love is from George Lucas, who is arguing that college admissions committees should start asking for creative portfolios, that along with your resume, your SAT scores, you know, some essays, you have to submit something creative. And it's up to you what you submit. It could be an original musical composition. It could be a little film that you made. It could be a story that you wrote. It could be an art project. I think that is a brilliant idea. It's going to make the work of admissions offices even more difficult and even more seemingly random, probably, than they already are. But I think it's absolutely worth it. And I think that if we start early and we get secondary students thinking about, look, the way that I achieve is actually by doing something new as opposed to just conforming to the majority, I think it would be a step in the right direction. So that's as far as my thinking has gotten for now, but I think this is a huge problem, and I would love, love, love to see more people working on it. What role does failure play in creative success? I think it plays a huge role. A lot of people are held back from bringing their original ideas to the table because they're afraid of failing. And let's illustrate this. Look around the room.
look for the most paranoid person here and then point at that person for me. Okay, don't actually do it. But what's funny is how many people point at themselves or think about it? And a lot of people are afraid that if they try an idea, they're going to get judged as a failure, that they're going to get stupid, get judged for looking stupid. The data show, though, that the most successful creative people are the ones who failed the most because they just tried more ideas. This is in chapter 2 for anyone who wants the data. But basically what you see is there's a positive relationship between the number of ideas that you try out and how original you ultimately become. Because if you only have a few ideas, then you don't get that much variety. If you generate lots of ideas, you're much more likely to stumble on something truly original. And my favorite example of this is with musical composers. So if you ask what distinguished Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart from their peers, their hit rates were not any higher than other musicians who were great but not quite as celebrated. What's different was they composed a lot more. So in some cases, over 1,000 compositions to get to just a few that are considered true masterpieces. And I think you have to fail a lot in order to achieve that kind of original success. One of the better examples is there's a guy who invented a talking doll long ago that was so creepy that it not only scared children, but adults too. And if you were afraid to fail, you never would have done that. But we don't judge him for creating that. We celebrate Thomas Edison for pioneering the light bulb. And if you look at what else Edison was doing during inventing the light bulb, it wasn't just the 10,000 failures to invent the light bulb. In that 5-year window, he tried to preserve fruit with a method that failed royally. He also tried to mine iron ore with magnets. Didn't work out so well. And he was willing to test all these ideas and embrace failure. And I think that's part of how he got to be original. So I think failure is essential. And what I found from interviewing a lot of originals is they are afraid of failure just like the rest of us. But even more than being afraid of failing, they are afraid of failing to try. They're worried about regretting inactions, not actions. And I think that's such a powerful thing to think about.
Hello, Professor Grant. One of the questions I have is, you know, when you think about a lot of the large companies and, you know, examples such as Kodak, that have been around and were market leaders and now are a fraction of what they used to be, it seems like a lot of it boils down to not having that type of original thinking.
Yeah.
But how do you do that in, you know, in today's society where speed is of the essence and you have shareholder targets to meet? And how do you have tolerance for that and be able to balance speed with also, you know, procrastination and things like that?
Yeah, go into work tomorrow and be like, you know, I'm going to be procrastinating for the next few weeks. Don't worry, though. Good ideas are about to come. I think this is hard. And in fact, to the Kodak point, chapter 7 is about the fall of Polaroid and why one of the most original companies of half a century ended up failing. So there are a couple of things that I think are really important here. One is to hire differently. So the mistake that a lot of companies make is they hire in ways that cause them to become less original over time. There's a study of Silicon Valley companies, over 200 of them before and after the dot-com boom and bust. And what you see is there are basically three ways that founders hire. They either hire on skills. It's like, okay, I need somebody who can program this kind of software. They hire on potential. I hire the smartest people and figure they can learn anything. Or they hire on culture fit. I want people who are going to embrace our values. So just out of curiosity, for those of you who do hiring, how many of you hire mostly on skills? Mostly on potential? Mostly on culture fit? All right, so the founders who hired on culture fit, they were less likely to fail when their startups began. They were more likely to go public and run successful companies. And then after that, their companies grew at a much slower rate than the ones who hired on skills and potential. So culture fit becomes dangerous over time. How? What it does is it leads to groupthink. Because you have all these original founders who are like, you know, I'm original, let me hire people who are exactly like me. And so what you get basically is homogeneity instead of diversity of thought. What I would love to see more companies do is instead of hiring on cultural fit, hire on cultural contribution. Instead of bringing in people who match and replicate what's already in the culture, ask what is missing from our culture, and then you prioritize that. And that's not just about hiring, right? It's also about rewarding and promoting people who represent things that are absent from your culture and enrich it. So I think that's one thing that I would do. A second thing that I would do is I would be really careful about shutting down suggestions, which most leaders do. And there's a great example of this, which is, think about what a typical boss would say here, and in a moment I'm going to ask you to fill in the blanks. All right, are you ready? Your boss would say, don't bring me. Bring me. Have you guys been practicing? That was good. This is a great way to be efficient, right? This is what leaders do to say, we are in a dynamic economy, we need to get things done faster. But it's also a great way to get a culture of advocacy instead of one of inquiry. Because if people can only bring problems to the table once they've already solved them, you're going to miss out on a lot of diversity of opinion. You're also going to not hear the hardest problems that no one knows how to solve themselves. So I actually think we need to reverse this equation, and we need to get leaders to say, bring me problems. I want to hear everything that's going wrong. Best example of this that I have ever seen is Ray Dalio. He's the billionaire founder of Bridgewater, the hedge fund that's been probably the most successful of the last 40 years. They were one of the few companies to predict the financial crisis in 2007 and warn their clients against it. Ray Dalio got an email a couple years ago from somebody three levels below him that said, Ray, I wanted to let you know, in this big client meeting we just had, I give you a D-. You rambled incoherently for over an hour. This was a huge client, and I think you blew it. And it went on, and it was even more acerbic than I just described. Now, I don't know many people who would write that kind of email to the billionaire founder of their company. I assume the guy's going to be fired. Ray replies and copies the entire executive committee of Bridgewater and says, I'm sorry I let you down. And then he tasks the executive committee to review his performance in similar meetings and see if there's a pattern. Then the co-CEO of Bridgewater CCs that email to the entire company so everyone can learn from Ray's mistake. I would love to have more leaders welcoming of problems like that, right? Because it signals to everybody that it's okay to bring ideas to the table. Now, not all of those ideas and suggestions are going to be good, right? And then you have to really hone your skill at selecting the right ideas. But I think that you need to increase the filter. One way you can do this practically is run an innovation tournament. Has anybody run innovation tournaments before? So a few of you have. It's a really simple process. You put out a call for certain kinds of innovation, like Dow Chemical did this for a decade. They said, we are looking for proposals to reduce waste or to enter new markets. We want them to cost a maximum of $200,000, and they need to be able to pay for themselves after a year. And anybody in the company can submit. They get hundreds of submissions, and then they have subject matter experts actually evaluate the proposals and then advance the best ones to a next round. So the people who have bad ideas get feedback. They get to learn next time. The people with great ideas, eventually, if they win the tournament, they get to create a new job for themselves, which is to implement the idea. Dow Chemical saved $175 million a year on over 500 ideas when they did this process, which is not bad. And I think that's a simple way to say, look, we want to innovate. We want new ideas. We want original thinking. But we also want to make it focused and not just have a suggestion box where people are like, yeah, I wish you cleaned the bathrooms more often. Well, I wish that too, but it's not going to help this company survive. So next question.
Could you please comment on any notable gender differences you discovered in your work on originals?
Yeah. Do you want the PC answer or the honest answer?
Honest.
Right. So this is the first question that Sheryl Sandberg asked me when we started talking about this book. And I didn't have good answers. So I was at an event that she hosted, and she said, what happens when you cut your originals data by gender? And I had never thought to do that before. This is before I'd started really thinking and writing about gender, and before she and I started working together. And I had a flight back here from San Francisco, and I had 6 hours. So I reanalyzed 10 years of data. And I was deeply disturbed by what I found. I naively thought that in the 21st century, we evaluated people on the basis of their ideas, not their gender and our stereotypes. And I could not have been more wrong. So Sheryl and I ended up writing an op-ed in the Times last year that summarized what I thought was the most powerful finding. It was called Speaking While Female. And what I found in several companies was that when men spoke up with ideas and suggestions, they got rewarded for it. When women spoke up, either they were perceived as too aggressive and they were punished, or they were barely heard. And this was startling. So what do we do about that? I think one thing we need to do is we need to become more conscious of these stereotypes, right? That even those of us who are well-intentioned toward gender equality still carry around these very basic ideas that men are supposed to be ambitious and results-oriented, and women are supposed to be communal and caring. And I think when we become more aware of those stereotypes, we can do a better job hearing ideas and suggestions from women. I think the other thing we need to do is we need to generate more blind submissions. So just like orchestras brought more women in by having blind auditions and you got to focus on the quality of music, and you found out on average women were often better players than men when you weren't blinded by your biases, I think that we could do the same thing with idea submissions, and I think that's part of the power of an innovation tournament. But even on that, we have to be careful. So Colbert did this recently, right? He made a commitment when he moved over to take over his new show. He said, I'm going to have more female writers. And he only has one woman writer, which is awful. And he was asked why, and he said, well, you know, we did a blind audition, and the jokes from women weren't just as funny. I don't believe that. I think he's developed taste for male humor, right? So female humor doesn't sound as funny to him. He's not used to it, or it's not his preference. But I think this is a big problem waiting to be solved. The one other thing I'll say about gender is there's not surprisingly a lot of historical evidence that many great original contributions have come from men, and in a lot of domains, fewer from women. Why is this? Well, the biggest reason it seems to be is that there's a big volume originality relationship. And historically, women were not given a chance to test out lots of ideas. They were often expected to be full-time caregivers. And so they literally didn't have the time available to generate lots of great creations. My hope is that we're going to see that change and that it's already begun to change. But I think this is a huge, huge problem, as big or bigger than the education one.
What was your motivation for this topic? Like, talk through sort of how you got to this. I mean, you'd written another book a few years back. There are some of the things I think in here that are overlapping with some of Gladwell's work, and clearly that worked out because he's right on the cover. So can you talk a little bit about how you got to this topic and how you focused on it?
Yeah. So the Warby Parker thing was a big part of it, right? Like, you can't make a decision that bad without losing sleep at night and wondering, like, what? I actually study this stuff for a living. Why am I still this bad at it? But another thing that happened was, so my first book, Give and Take, was about the relationship between generosity and success. And two things happened that really got me interested in this topic. One was I found that I had to go against the grain quite a bit, and that I, especially when speaking to investment banks and a lot of Silicon Valley, there were people who said, you know, that's ridiculous that helping others could make you more successful. You have to be ruthless and cutthroat and selfish. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, how do I present and package these ideas in a way that people really understand them? And I realized that was just a microcosm of, you know, thinking about, okay, how do you champion original ideas? And I guess what also happened was I had a lot of students with great ideas who were afraid to act on them and were constantly asking, you know, how do I innovate inside my company? Or when I go and pitch my idea and try to get funding if I want to be an entrepreneur, how do I get people to listen to it, knowing the more original it is, the harder it is for people to accept? And I wanted to know more about how to solve that. I had a lot of leaders also saying, I really struggle with groupthink, and I want to get people to bring in more diverse thinking. And so I realized those are kind of two sides of the same coin, that, you know, individuals championing new ideas and leaders welcoming them was a topic we didn't understand well, that there are lots of books about creativity, which is about generating ideas. This book is like the sequel to creativity, right? Once you have an idea, what do you do with it? How do you speak up without getting silenced? How do you create an organization that welcomes new ideas? Or how do you raise a child who wants to think differently? And I guess the one other thing that happened that really got me excited about this was when I studied givers and takers, there was a lot of confusion. So givers are people who like helping others. Takers are people who basically try to get more than they give. A lot of people said this is like a nice guy's finish first story. But givers are not necessarily nice people. There's a separate trait called agreeableness disagreeableness, which is about your outer veneer. How pleasant is it to interact with you? So a lot of people think agreeable people are givers, disagreeable people are takers. But there is no correspondence between them. Because you can be prickly on the surface, but have other people's best interests at heart. So I think it's useful, and this is one way that I've kind of connected the two books, to think about this two by two. So there are lots of agreeable givers out there. They're nice, they say yes to everything. There are also disagreeable takers out there, which are easy to spot, and we might call them by a slightly different name. But the other two combinations really get overlooked. They're agreeable takers, also known as fakers, who are delightful to interact with, and then will throw you under the bus or stab you in the back. And then there's this fourth group of people who are responsible for most of the originality in the world, the disagreeable givers. The people who might be gruff and tough on the surface, but underneath have other people's best interests at heart. If you have a hard time imagining a disagreeable giver, there was an engineer at Google who put this perfectly. He said, oh, a disagreeable giver? That's just somebody with a bad user interface, but a great operating system. I was like, if that helps you. These are the people who challenge the status quo most comfortably, right? They want to make the organization better, and they do it by giving the critical feedback that nobody wants to hear, but everyone needs to hear. And there is, I should just say as a quick aside before we wrap and go to book signing, there is one country that struggles more with this than any other because it's the most agreeable country on the planet. Anybody know what that is? It is Canada, yes. I apologize to the Canadians in the room. But you won't be offended because you're probably agreeing. No. There are three nationally representative cross-cultural studies comparing Canadians to many, many other countries. And Canada does have the average highest agreeableness, except for Quebec, which loads on the disagreeable side with France. There was a radio station in the 70s that said, we are so agreeable that we don't have enough national pride. We need to stand up for our values. We need more Canadian slogans. So they took as American as apple pie, and they asked people to come up with a Canadian equivalent. Now, 4 million Canadians voted for the national slogan that you will not believe. I thought it was going to be as Canadian as maple syrup or ice hockey. But no, the winning entry is the best demonstration of Canadian agreeableness ever. They said, we want our national slogan to be as Canadian as possible under the circumstances. Now, for those of you who are highly agreeable or slightly Canadian, you get this right away. How could I ever say I'm any one thing when I'm constantly adapting and trying to please other people? If that's you, it's well to remember, it's just because someone is nice to you does not mean they actually care about you. And you need those disagreeable givers in your life. Those are the people who are going to challenge you the most, who are going to make your ideas better. And yes, they will be harder on you. But if you can convert them into allies, they are the ones who are not willing to stand, who are not willing to sit down and stay silent. They're the people who are comfortable rocking the boat and going to bat for you. And so even though they're the toughest people to pitch your ideas to, they are ultimately your best allies. So before we go to book signing, I just wanted to say thank you to a couple amazing givers and originals in this room. Nicole Granite and Sarah Beckoff read every word of this book, gave phenomenal feedback, and I scrapped a couple chapters because of them, which some of you will thank them for. Secondly, Carolyn Colburn, a fantastic publicist, is the reason that these ideas might actually see the light of day. And finally, Reb Rebeli has been working with me for the past 3 years. He's an applied positive psychology expert who's at Penn, knows more about originality and curiosity and creativity than anyone I've ever met. And I've learned a tremendous amount from him, and I'm deeply grateful to all of these people in the room. Thank you all for coming. It's been an honor.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.